Colonel Burke, reel 15.
And we went fairly well. We got through the German front line. We got through their local support line. And we were going on, passing a place called Lake Farm, because there was a huge lake in front of our battalion sector, the Bellaward Lake. And beyond that was Lake Farm, or so we called it, you see, on our map. And there our CO was killed. Well, the second in command took over, and we went on a tiny bit further. I came up to the CO, saw him, and it was just after that that I got hit and started to come home, come back to the battalion dressing station. Yes.
Could you describe for me the actual problems of, after you left the trench in the attack, of crossing the territory, which
well,
the artillery...
when you get out and you get on top, you try and keep as straight a line as possible, and you are spaced 3 to 4 yards interval, and you are going forward at the high port, that is, with the rifle diagonally across your chest, with the bayonet pointing upwards towards the sky. We reckoned to do a minute to a minute and a half, 100 yards. We know one can run it in 9 seconds, but with the shell holes and the men having to go round them, at the same time being fired on, and at the same time trying to keep their distance between one another and keep their alignment. And it was only when you got to within 20 yards of the trench that you said charge. They then brought their rifles facing the enemy, charged into the trench and killed and bayoneted and troops, and immediately that was on. You didn't wait to look at the wounded or take prisoners, you went on, because you had a certain sector. We had to go to the first two lots of trenches, after which my supporting company would jump through me and I would become the local reserve, you see, to that battalion. But before this happened, I was wounded.
I see. In this attack, and in perhaps other attacks in which you took part, how regularly was it the case that you would get close enough for hand-to-hand fighting with the enemy?
Only if your battle was successful. For instance, on July the 1st, on the Somme, we never got to the German trenches. We were held up by their wire. And when we could get through the wire, there were so few left that it was impossible. We came back. But the normal thing, you got into the trench and you did your job there through... if there weren't many troops about, you knew there must be more, so you threw hand bombs down the... dugouts, because this time the Germans had deep dugouts. They might be 20 steps down. That wasn't so much to kill them, because they wouldn't have been at the bottom unless they were coming up. It was to keep them there, you see.
I was talking recently to an infantry soldier, a private soldier who served from 14 until he was wounded in the Battle of the Somme, and I asked him how often he used his bayonet. He said, I used it quite a lot for chopping firewood.
Yes. There were very few times, I think, that after 1914, when we hadn't got trenches, and when you really did charge, and there was hand-to-hand fighting. But you see, having once lunged with your bayonet, it was impossible. You had to defend yourself. You probably used it then, holding on to the barrel and using the butt more than the bayonet. No, one didn't use the bayonet a lot.
In the attacks in which you took part, how often did you actually get to bayonet fighting distance?
Twice. Twice. For instance, this case on 31st of July, we got in the trench and we were bayoneting them. You see, but that only lasts a few seconds.
There was, I think, a popular belief or tradition that the Germans don't like cold steel kind of thing.
No, well...
On the evidence of your experiences when hand-to-hand fighting did take place, did it seem to confirm that?
Oh, yes. Well, we were the same. We were the same. I mean, when they got that close, you put your hands up. But the instructors at our depot and all wherever it was, when they were training recruits and you were on bayonet training, they used to tell them to lunge, and 4 inches was enough. But before they withdrew, give the bayonet a twist to make the wound incurable. That always stuck in my mind. Because it wasn't so much that. That wasn't the reason for doing it, but that's the way they put it. Mm. Because that stuck in your memory. If they said, give the bayonet a twist because you'll find you won't be able to pull it out unless the fellow's on the ground, you can put your foot on him. But if you gave it a twist, it released it from the suction or being in a bone or anything like that. And you had to. So they used to say, give the bayonet a twist to make the wound incurable. Mm-hmm. And that always remained in your memory. That's the shoulder.
Tell me, can you remember exactly how you got your wound?
Yes, when you get to the trench, you see, you're up to the last moment, you're seeing if your men are there, and if you've got any left, you jump into the trench, and the German put his bayonet up, and I'm afraid I caught it in the right shoulder, right across my back, just missing my spine. And I was impaled on this. And my only fear was that he would press the trigger, which would have made a hell of a mess. But in the meantime, my sergeant, who was near, he saw me. He came in close, shot the fellow, and then hoisted me with the help of another man off the bayonet because I was on top of the man, you see, and he was dead in the rifle.
Mm.
Mm. Yes, it wasn't pleasant. Mm. Well, I was a walking... After this, I was a walking wounded. A bayonet wound, directly it goes in, it hurts. And the withdrawal is probably further anguish than the putting in, because the putting in is instantaneous. But you get hit by a bullet or a bomb splinter or anything else, it's so hot that it cauterizes the wound and you don't feel anything for possibly a minute or so. Anyhow, having been wounded, I was patched up and told to go on my way. Well, as you go back, you find that there are tapes which had been put down as you came up. You see the long lines of tape, and you follow these, and then you suddenly come to flags which are stuck in, marked RA, Regimental Aid Post. So you'd follow the flag and you'd come to the regimental aid post where the doctor would probably laugh like hell when he saw you. Said, ha-ha, you copped it at last or something. Do you up, because you only had your field dressing on, do you up with a better bandage and said, well, it's about another mile down, you can manage, and off you went. There were no drinks or anything there for you. If you were in pain, they gave you a dose of morphia. And you were on your way. Well, then, of course, you slithered and slipped and slided down on and on and on, thinking you were never going to get to this place, when suddenly you found it.
What place?
And in this case, the casualty clearing station. Mm. In this case, it was at Hellfire Corner. Now, Hellfire Corner was at the end of the Menin Road, and on the right was the White Chateau, and on the left was the entrance to this communication trench, which was, I have already told you, about 2,000 yards long. Well, there, in the remains of the White Chateau, they did emergency operations, if they had to, but he didn't want to. And then you were moved...
Do you remember what the scene in the casualty clearing station was like?
Oh, yes. Hundreds of fellows on stretchers, moaning and waiting for treatment, and... Well, you simply sat down and waited. It wasn't the case because you were an officer, you got treated first. You sat down. In fact, you, if you could move at all, you helped move these poor wretched fellows so that they could get better treatment. And there were there, you see, At the casualty clearing station, there were beds and tents and nurses. And it was from those, then you got moved to they were like a field, more or less a field hospital. And it was there you got moved to the base hospitals, strictly you could, because they had to keep clearing you out, you see. Well, in the case at the base hospital, you were looked at, and if you were, the doctor thought you were bad enough, you immediately were shot onto a hospital ship, and that waited till it was filled up. But the other cases which were bad had to wait for possibly an operation, or possibly till they were out of a fever, or fit to be moved, to take the journey across the sea to a British hospital, not the sea. Mm.
In your case, you went on to a rest camp.
Well, I went on to, I was in the hospital, the base hospital, for a bit, and then went on to a rest camp and at La Trépore, and then rejoined my unit.
Hmm. Well, what on the whole was the quality of medical services?
Wonderful. Hmm. But what you've got to remember is a lot more men died between being wounded and getting to a casualty clearing station or a base hospital, simply because there was no blood plasma in those days, you see. And also their journey, especially if you were on a stretcher, your journey was very precarious. A fellow stepped on what he thought was a piece of the road. Well, it was a hole. Well, down he'd go, and over would go the stretcher, and possibly you would be hurled into the road. And so you got so much mud that and dirt into the wound that gangrene, that was the trouble. Mm. Gangrene was the worst enemy.
Now, after your period in the rest camp, you went back to the Ypres sector in September of 17 and were there for several months, which included the Battle of Passchendaele. The winter of 17-18 was perhaps one of the first, one of the worst of the of the war period.
Yeah.
Could you give me some specific examples of the conditions it created in the sector you were in?
Well, we went then, when we moved into the line again, we went through our old line and the Germans, because the attack had gone right on to Passchendaele Crossroads. That's where our front line was, although we hadn't taken the village of Passchendaele. And you went along a what is known as a corduroy track. Well, it was made of thousands and thousands and thousands of railway sleepers. And that was so the guns could get across the country, because it was so waterlogged and so the shells interlocked. Now, we'll take going up to Passchendaele round about November. We'd start off, and it would probably be 3 miles to the front. And if we did it in 3 hours, we were lucky. It was dark. The duckboards were icy. And the man was weighed down like a Christmas tree. He was carrying extra barbed wire, a roll of that, between two. Or he was carrying two or three iron pickets, 6 feet long or 4 feet long. There was the company orderly, who all the men looked at or wanted to know how he was getting on, carrying the rum. And when a fella fell down, if he rolled off, it was a double track, duckboard track, so it was about, a yard wide, a bit more. And if you fell off, you sometimes fell into a shell hole. Oh, it would be 4 foot deep. Before you could, you see, at first the men started to try and rescue the fellow. But you had to leave him. He'd gone. And there was nothing you could do about it. There were any amount drowned. Their equipment was so heavy.